May it please the Court? Well, the issue in this case is whether the trial court was incorrect in denying the motion to suppress evidence that was found after Mr. Grayson's arrest, which was pursuant to a warrant, but that warrant was only discovered due to his illegal seizure and detention. Now, the state still contends that the stop of his vehicle was justified by reasonable suspicion. Now, in this case, the officer received a call from dispatch, which was from an anonymous tip that alleged a possible drunk driver had left a nearby residential address in Newburgh, Missouri. It also gave the name of the driver, Terry Reed, stated that he had a parole warrant out for his arrest, and that he was in a red Ford pickup. Instead, officer pulled over Mr. Grayson, who he thought resembled the named suspect, even though he was in a different make of truck, and even though he followed Mr. Grayson for several blocks and didn't observe any signs of intoxication or wrongdoing. Now, the law seems fairly well settled that an anonymous tip that is vague in its allegations of criminal wrongdoing, that is not corroborated by the officer, either as to the identifying details of the tip or to any wrongdoing, is not going to provide reasonable suspicion. The thing is, even if it had provided reasonable suspicion to pull over Mr. Reed or Mr. Grayson, as soon as the officer walked up to the truck, he saw that Mr. Grayson was not the person he was looking for. And instead of releasing him, he decided to detain him solely to look for warrants, because he knew that Mr. Grayson had been arrested on warrants in the past. But he had no knowledge that he had a warrant at that time. And he testified to that at the motion to suppress hearing. So the detention was unlawful. Now, in the course of that detention, he discovered that he had a municipal arrest warrant for possession of marijuana. So he arrested him pursuant to that warrant, searched him, took him to the station, and found drugs and drug paraphernalia. Now, we believe that the exclusionary rule applies to this and that the evidence has not been attenuated solely due to discovery of the warrant. Now, the state would like to argue, you know, basically just that the warrant itself is a per se rule is going to attenuate any evidence found afterwards, because the evidence was found as a valid search incident to arrest. However, that does not cure the illegal detention and seizure that happened before then. Now, the other states that seem to be determining that the warrant is always going to be an intervening circumstance do not seem to be applying that the factors for attenuation that this state set forth in State versus Miller or Brown versus Illinois in the United States Supreme Court. And if we apply those factors to the situation here, the temporal proximity of the discovery of the evidence to the illegality was mere minutes. It was minutes from the time that he pulled him over, that he took his license, ran it for a check, and arrested him and took him to the station. So the temporal proximity was very short. Now, as far as the intervening circumstances, the only thing we have is the discovery of the warrant. And then we look at the purpose and the flagrancy of the officer misconduct. Now, the officer was detaining Mr. Grayson solely to check for a warrant. This is exactly the kind of investigation, not based on reasonable suspicion, in which the officer hopes that they're going to turn up something that we want to deter. Now, the fact that he did turn up an arrest warrant shouldn't cure the fact that he, you know, the evidence that he found afterwards, because this is going to encourage officers to basically go on a fishing expedition, pulling people over or checking their licenses for warrants when they have no suspicion that one exists.
The opposing counsel argues that they would inevitably, even if they'd let him go, they would have continued to check and would have found the warrant and just followed him and arrested him 5 minutes later, so it's an inevitable discovery kind of argument.
Well, the thing about the inevitable discovery is that the state's argument that, well, we would have done it correctly if we hadn't done it incorrectly, it's the kind of speculative argument that really is not going to show inevitable discovery. Now, the state had to establish that certain proper, predictable procedures were being followed here and that they would have resulted in the inevitable discovery of this evidence. Now, the fact that the arrest warrant existed and Mr. Grayson may have inevitably been arrested on this warrant doesn't say when or where this would have occurred. And it only occurred at this time and at this place because of his illegal detention and seizure. The state also argues that the warrant was an independent source, but the warrant really can't act as an independent source when the officer wasn't aware of it before he detained the person. Now, this isn't the kind of situation like in Segura versus United States, where they had applied for a warrant and they committed an illegal entry while they were waiting for that warrant to be forthcoming. Here, the officer had absolutely no idea if there was a warrant or not. He just knew that Mr. Grayson had been arrested before. And State versus Hawkins is one case that says just knowledge of somebody's prior arrest alone is not going to be the basis of reasonable suspicion. Now, reasonable suspicion is a totality of the circumstances test, so it could potentially be a factor, but if it is the only thing, and it was the only reason that the officer had for detaining him here, that's not going to be the basis for reasonable suspicion. Now, the other cases, I want to point to some of the other states that have decided that the warrant was going to be an attenuating or an intervening circumstance. Again, they seem to be ignoring several of the factors from the Brown or Miller test for attenuation. First one is temporal proximity. Texas, for instance, decided they weren't going to look at that at all. And the reason why that they gave was slightly strange. Well, in Brown versus Illinois, it was that the defendant had voluntarily given statements, and they determined that that was the attenuating factor. So it was a voluntary act on the part of the defendant. Well, these courts said, yeah, there's not really any voluntary act here, so we're just not going to look at the temporal proximity because it doesn't really weigh into this equation. Well, that seems kind of strange. And then a lot of the courts didn't even look at whether or not the officer conduct was flagrant. They just said a warrant is going to be an intervening circumstance. Now, I think that this is really against United States Supreme Court precedent in Brown, because the court there said we do not want to adopt a per se rule that something is always going to be an intervening circumstance. And in that case, it was giving Miranda warnings as to whether or not the statements needed to be suppressed. But I just think adopting a per se rule in general is not what the courts want, and I think it's really against their precedent. So,
what about this argument that you know, this guy was somewhat of a frequent flyer, that as soon as he saw him, the reason he recognized him was because he was somebody who had previously on multiple occasions been picked up on outstanding warrants. What if upon immediately recognizing him, instead of going back, he just said, oh, I'm sorry, I pulled you over by mistake, but now, Mr. Grayson, do you have any outstanding warrants? Would that have been appropriate?
Oh, rather than demanding his license and taking it back to his patrol car?
Yeah. What if he just said, you're not who I thought you was, but now we picked you up on outstanding warrants before. Is there anything I need to know about before I check your license, Mr. Grayson?
Yeah, well, being that that was an unlawful detention, Mr. Grayson wouldn't have had to answer, and he should have been free to leave. But the officer did testify that he wasn't free to leave, showing that he had been detained. So,
How likely is it for someone who stopped by a police officer to say, I'm not going to give you my license and I'm free to leave, and just drive off?
Right. That seems to be kind of a legal fiction where, you know, you should be free to leave, but at least in this case, we know Officer Lambert said he wasn't free to leave. So if he had tried to leave, he would have been detained. So, and the thing is, I don't know, the state argues that he had been arrested multiple times. We actually don't know how many times he had been arrested previously. The officer testified that he knew there had been sometimes warrants out for Mr. Grayson's arrest, and he knew that he'd been arrested previously. But we don't know how long it was since the last warrant, how many times this occurred. I mean, really, poor Mr. Grayson, could he ever really walk out of his home without thinking he's going to be detained by any officer who knows he's been arrested previously? And knowledge of somebody's prior criminal activity.
Could probable cause be you live in a town and you know this guy's had problems, or has been said a quote-unquote frequent flyer. You stop him, you know there's going to be some problems there. Is that always then going to be probable cause, or do you have to have probable cause for the specific incident that the officer's investigating?
Yes, the officer had to have reasonable suspicion or probable cause at that time. And his statement that he knew he didn't know that there was a warrant really doesn't give him any kind of justification, because he knows that Mr. Grayson has a past history of detaining him. Otherwise, every person who's had a prior arrest or a prior conviction could be detained by any officer at any time. And especially in Newburgh, which is a town of less than 500 people, it seems like if you're arrested once, you better just move away, because if any officer knows you, then they're going to detain you on the street, and that can't be the kind of cause that would meet constitutional muster.
The state also relies on Hudson, which is the knock and announce rule, and basically said that the purpose served by the knock and announce rule would not be served by excluding evidence that was discovered when the officers did not wait before going in. And they say here, since there was a warrant, it would not serve any larger purpose to exclude the evidence because they discovered the warrant during an illegal detention.
Well, that's the interesting thing, that the state is relying upon Hudson, as did the Court of Appeals below, saying that somehow maybe Hudson made new law. But the thing is, Hudson is not the case that rejected the but-for analysis. It was actually Wong Sung decades ago. And they said that the appropriate question is not, whether the evidence was going to be discovered but for the illegal conduct of the officers, but whether or not the evidence was found by exploitation of the police illegality. And in Hudson, they determined there was actually no direct causation at all, because the violation of the knock and announce rule is not why they had the warrant.
It's Justice Kennedy who was the deciding vote, and he's the one that sets the law on Hudson, as he did on Seaford, another case. But Are we limited? Could there be another situation where, you know, we could find, not only not going to announce, but in a different situation, say, the Fourth Amendment and exclusionary rule are not connected, that they somehow, you know, there's a disconnect, and so in a different situation, not going to announce, but another situation we could find as Supreme Court of Missouri that there's you don't exclude the evidence.
Potentially, but I think that we should have some either basis in what the exceptions to the exclusionary rule are now, or United States Supreme Court precedent. And basically, the United States Supreme Court, they were underscoring, they weren't changing their law as far as the exclusionary rule's application to violations of unreasonable searches and seizures. They just said we are not going to apply it in this case because there's no direct causation. Direct causation is the threshold, and then we have to look at whether or not it would be appropriate to exclude the evidence, looking at the purposes of the exclusionary rule, which is officer deterrence. And basically, this seems like exactly the kind of situation we would want to deter, is officers detaining people with no basis just to look for a warrant.
If there's an outstanding warrant for arrest, what sort of expectations do you have to be free from a seizure if you're found by law enforcement? In other words, some of those cases that some of those states that say, well, if there's a warrant, that's justification, regardless of how you find out about it. I mean, if there's already a valid outstanding warrant for your arrest, what are your reasonable expectations of your privacy if there's already a finding and an outstanding warrant? Why doesn't that find you wherever it finds you, whether you're in a valid checkpoint or stop for something else, or just sitting at home and they're on one of those weekend trips where they try to pick people up?
Well, that's an interesting question. We know that the officer didn't know about the warrant, but there's also no evidence on the record that my client had any awareness that he had this warrant out for his arrest either. Perhaps if he had known, he would have turned himself in, but this was something the state didn't prove. And this, again, was a municipal warrant for possession of marijuana. I don't know if this is something that even required a full custodial arrest at that time, but that was something the state didn't prove as well. So, sorry, no.
Was there a bond requirement already set on the outstanding warrant for which he was arrested on?
That's not on the record.
May it please the court. This court's decision in State v. Miller is based on the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Illinois v. Brown. In Illinois v. Brown, U.S. Supreme Court cited an example of attenuation in the case of Johnson v. Louisiana. In Johnson v. Louisiana, the defendant was illegally detained. Following his illegal detention, there was a valid commitment order entered, and the U.S. Supreme Court found that a lineup done after that valid commitment order was not the fruit of the poisonous tree because that valid commitment order was an intervening circumstance that cut off the prior illegal detention.
Does that mean the state could just randomly pick up people and then check their warrants, and then they just would continue holding the ones who had warrants and that would validate it and be okay? Or is the reason for the warrant requirement, the reason for the illegal detention prohibition, so that the innocent citizens are not just randomly stopped, but the police actually only stop on reasonable suspicion?
Judge, I do not think that when you look around the country and look at all these cases, attenuation does not lead to additional violation of the initial detention.
Would your argument permit that?
The what happens after the lawful arrest warrant. You'd still have the invalidity of the initial stop, which would still give grounds to other alternative remedies would be available for the initial constitutional violation.
You're talking that you could sue the police.
That'd be one possibility.
If you happen to be one of the assault. Has that ever been found to be sufficient in itself, or do we also have the exclusionary rule because the ability to use a Bivens-type remedy is not adequate?
What the U.S. Supreme Court said in Hudson, what's said in other cases, is it doesn't assume that the exclusionary rule is the only mechanism for deterrence, and that it's not we're not going to go to the exclusionary rule just because of there's this argument of a need for deterrence, that we give some weight to the fact that the other possibilities do have some deterrent effect, that police are going to try to follow proper procedures.
But didn't Hudson involve the knock and announce rule, and they were waiting for a warrant, and the warrant came right after, so they said it really was no direct cause of finding the illegal evidence. The violation of the rule is not what led to the discovery of the evidence for which he was convicted.
That was part of the analysis.
Didn't Kennedy say this only has application in this knock and announce context and shouldn't be applied more broadly?
You still have this same reading that's gone through.
Is that what Kennedy said?
I believe so. But you still have the broader concept that this has been said in several different cases, which is Herring, Hudson, several others have been that we're not, and this is what the concern about attenuation has been, which is that when you get these cases for attenuation, the response of the defendant always seems to be coming back to but for, that, well, you started this process and how you, from the start of the process, it led down inevitably to your finding the evidence and seems to be taking of the but for analysis. That if you hadn't initially legally detained me, you would never have found out I had a warrant, and therefore it's a but-for cause, and therefore you shouldn't find attenuation. But in every attenuation case, you're going to have a but-for cause. The question is, do you have a proximate cause, taking the civil term? And is the intervening circumstance, and that we say, is it legally significant enough that it matters? And that sort of goes back to what happened in Brown, which is they said, we're not going to create a per se rule for Miranda warnings because we don't think Miranda warnings in the second factor is significant enough. You've got a three-factor balancing test, and contrary to what Appellant has said, all these states that I've cited in my brief do engage in all three parts of the balancing test. They've said, we've looked at temporal. We don't think that temporal particularly fits well in the circumstances, not to be given much weight given the other factors involved. They've also looked at and said, yes, as far as significant attenuating circumstances, a warrant is a pretty significant attenuating circumstance.
Are you, in effect, you're arguing, though, that it should be, if you have that, no other factor matters, that it's automatically attenuating, if it turns out they find an outstanding warrant?
There could be circumstances in which the other two factors would outweigh. I don't want to say that there will never be a case of such flagrant police misconduct that the third factor wouldn't come.
Well, here it was immediate during the illegal detention, so the temporal factor clearly favors defendant completely.
Correct.
So what are you saying could make the difference then?
It would be then come down to the third factor, the flagrancy. And I think that I think this is what you sort of got cited in the Fletcher case from Texas, which is, if you had something showing that this was an ongoing practice of basically that they were randomly stopping people just in the hopes of finding
warrants. So an individual defendant could never overcome the fact that there was a warrant. You would have to show a pattern in practice and do a larger survey of what the particular locality was doing?
That would be one thing. I don't think you necessarily have to show a survey, but if you showed that in this individual officer, this was following some type of policy or some type of thing that would show that it wasn't just, and as argued in this case, that went a little too far on the stop.
So it wouldn't have to do with protecting defendants' rights. It would have to do with an extra prophylactic rule to correct police misconduct.
Which is all the exclusionary rule is. That's what the Supreme Court has said consistently. It's not about benefiting the defendant. It's about the need to prevent police misconduct in appropriate cases where we think that the weighing of the pros and cons of the exclusionary rule, because the con of the exclusionary rule is the cost of letting a guilty defendant go free, that the benefit of preventing police misconduct is serious enough that you want to say that this is such a serious violation that we're going to apply the exclusionary
rule. Does it really prevent police misconduct?
The exclusionary rule?
Yes.
I think it has some benefit of preventing police misconduct. I think what you've got is that law enforcement internalizes the norms of what is expected behavior. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be officers who are going to make a mistake, which this officer clearly made a mistake. He thought he recognized someone as the person who he had been told had a warrant outstanding for them, stopped that person, discovered that it wasn't the person. Clearly a mistake of the officer on the scene. But he was not going out there saying, I'm going to randomly stop anyone I see and pull them over. He was looking for a specific person, just made a mistake as to whom he was looking for.
The judgment in this case seems to be an opposite to the decision in Tabor. Can you distinguish the two cases?
Basically, Tabor doesn't even address attenuation. That's the distinction. There's nothing in Tabor that shows that the Western District...
Aren't the facts pretty similar?
The facts are similar.
And the holdings are opposite.
The holdings are opposite because the issue apparently wasn't raised in Tabor, that the Tabor court shows nowhere in its opinion that they ever considered whether or not a warrant would be an attenuating factor. They just assumed that it was fruit of the poisonous tree without any analysis. I can't say for sure what result they would have reached if they had done attenuation analysis, but the decision in Tabor seems to be the opposite of a prior decision from the same district in Lemaster, which did find that a warrant was attenuated.
Where does the three-factor test come from?
Three-factor test comes from Brown. And Brown's, of course, cites the cases that they see point to as examples of where those factors were present. As clearly one of the cases that was cited to Brown as a intervening circumstances was Johnston, about having something that intervened that made it into valid custody.
Has any U.S. Supreme Court case held that discovering a warrant is in itself is the dispositive factor and you don't need to consider other factors?
Nothing they've said expressly. I know the Supreme Court has looked at cases like Harris versus New York and have said in Harris that the intervening circumstance of the valid detention was an intervening circumstance that justified the statement afterwards, even though the initial contact was an illegal search into the person's house, but the intervening valid arrest separated you from the taint of the initial illegal entry into the house. One thing that I would note is that if you look at all these cases around the country, what you have in this case falls somewhere in the middle when you compare to the circumstance that the other courts have looked at. You had, in the Florida case, what you had was a stop for a broken taillight, which in Florida, the court itself notes that a broken taillight is not a primary enforcement offense in Florida, and therefore there wasn't even a colorable basis for the police stopping in the Florida case. In this case, you at least have a colorable basis for the initial stop. Erroneous because he recognized the wrong person, but I think most human beings, especially at a distance, we all know times that we've thought we've seen someone that we recognize, and then when we get closer, we realize, no, it's someone different.
But he had no colorable basis for the continued detention, did he? Even assuming seeing that a different model truck that was not weaving gave him...
Other than that, his prior experience with this person having been a person who has outstanding warrants, which I think that's something that's as it. We're not yet up to the date where every officer is going to instantaneously recognize what warrant is outstanding, but a warrant is an order from a court to arrest a person on site.
You're going to say we should hold that police can simply detain anyone who they know has had a past warrant to see if they have a present one?
I don't think I'm saying that. I'm saying that's a factor to be considered in terms of the overall analysis.
How does the statute 575-180, the obligation on a law enforcement officer to arrest a person with a warrant, how does that play? Because does that support Judge Diss' concern that police officers, if they're all obligated by statute to arrest anybody with a warrant, must check every single person to see if they have warrants?
I don't know that statute goes that far. I do know that you have, in a somewhat analogous situation, not completely analogous, but somewhat analogous, in the case of someone who's bonded out from jail. Once they're bonded out from jail, theoretically they're free to go, but we've said by statute that before releasing them, we want you to run a warrant check on the person before we release them, and made the failure to run a warrant check on that person before releasing them punishable by a misdemeanor. I think there is some feeling, at least among the public,
but they're being legally detained at that point.
They'll be legally detained until either they release because their sentence has expired or they're released because right. the person's coming
so,
and posted
so
the bond.
So at the time you're
them.
Running that warrant check, they're in legal custody of the police, correct? Isn't that the key distinction?
Depends upon when the warrant check's being run, because the second that someone comes and posts the bond for them, at that point, they're no longer being completely. And so, I'm not sure I want to say the word not being legally held, but there is, at that point, there is an entitlement to be released because the reason for your detention has ended once the bond's been posted. But the statute still says before you can release them, even though their bond's been posted, you have to run the warrant check.
So that's part of the statute, posting the bond and checking the warrant is part of the legal basis for getting released?
Yes. Okay. There's still, I think that statute still shows the fact that there is something reasonable or perceived as reasonable in the public about not wanting to let people go once you've had the initial valid detention until you've confirmed there's nothing outstanding, that we don't want people who have to be able to flee from justice just because the police didn't have a chance to confirm that they are in fact a fugitive from justice. And that's the circumstance you have in this case. The person does have an outstanding warrant. The person has no entitlement at that moment to be free. The warrant, the officers, as soon as they find him, are supposed to serve and execute that warrant. And that's a court order, and that compared to some of the other things that we've said, that warrantless detentions under some circumstances are valid. And there is a preference in the Constitution for warrants. And that's all we're saying, which is having this warrant, there should be some constitutional significance given to the fact that this warrant exists.
How common is it to have a warrant just among the population of males of a certain age in that area?
Nothing in the record, Your Honor, to tell us the percentage of the population.
Just wondering if it was 1 out of 2 or 1 out of 50.
I don't know what the percentage is, Your Honor. Obviously, I can tell you the typical procedure for anyone who's ever done trial court work is municipal courts normally would have gotten the summons at the time the marijuana had been found and would have been given the court date and would have normally you get a municipal warrant from a failure to appear for your court date. And I can't say that's what happened in this case. That's the normal way you get a municipal warrant.
Now, when they stop you, now I've never been stopped at by any police officer on any of these kind of things. But when they stop you, don't they ask for your license and then could they just take your license and run it through the computer to find if you have a warrant?
That's normally how you find a warrant. Either they ask for your license, they may hold your license, they may just ask you to give.
Would they stop you, take your license, and then check warrants?
I couldn't say whether or not what percentage of time they hold the license, what percentage of time they just write down the information from the license and called in.
Here the officer did not run the plate and see who owned the car before he stopped him, and he did not run the license until after he'd already determined that it was not the person he'd received the tip about. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that's the problem here, is he didn't do it in a way that during his reasonable suspicion period.
Correct, Your Honor. But obviously we think that, as I said, that's something that can be addressed, but still the question of does the warrant itself, from that moment, there's a valid basis for holding the person. The warrant says the person to be arrested on site, and the question is, do we recognize that as a valid basis for holding the person? You're going to say that despite the existence of the warrant, police should still let this person go and ignore the court order. And we don't think the police should just let a person with the warrant go. Thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify a couple things. First, Johnson versus Louisiana, the United States Supreme Court case, the issue before the court was not whether or not the arrest was illegal. The court actually never decided that. What they determined was, regardless of whether or not the arrest was illegal, and there it seemed like the person had been identified on photographs, so I don't know what the court would have decided, they were then brought before a magistrate who then, explained their rights to them, set bail, and then the person obtained an attorney before they went to a lineup. So if we're going to be applying the factors of attenuation to that case, it does seem like the temporal proximity was much longer. And in general, a defendant that is brought before a magistrate, that is something that is seen to be an intervening circumstance. It's just another factor situation. I don't think that changed the law any more than Hudson or Segura changed the law, honestly.
Would you agree that generally when the exclusionary rule applies, it applies to deter law enforcement from using bad faith methods to arrest people? In this case, would the record support that it's bad faith on behalf of this officer or just good luck on behalf of this officer?
Well, actually, I believe that this is an objective test, so we're not really looking at that officer's subjective good faith.
Well, in Seifert, when they decided the Kennedy's vote, they used a subjective test.
Oh, interesting.
They looked into the controlling vote, as Judge Tottleman indicates, often the controlling vote, the one necessary to get the decision, is Kennedy. And in Seifert, they, you know, that he, although neither the four on each side didn't want a subjective test because it's hard for us to figure out what's in the mind of an officer,
right,
just like in this case. But, you know, if that's when the exclusionary rule really is supposed to apply, when law enforcement are using bad faith or bad means, is there any indication in this case that the guy was using any bad faith?
Well, in when we're litigating issues on motions to suppress, we often have to look at what the officer is thinking. So whether we're litigating subjective or objective officer good faith in all of these situations, this officer thought that he was pulling over somebody else. And as soon as he saw this person, he realized it wasn't the person that he sought. And then he detained him solely to check for a warrant. So if we're going to be looking at bad faith, I think that the officer here, that this was pretty flagrant misconduct.
But if the facts had been just a little different, if the facts had been that he knew for sure that he had outstanding existing warrants, would you have a complaint then?
No, I think that would be a much different situation.
It's just that the problem is that he didn't know for sure, and he was just wondering whether or not there was any warrants because of the person's alleged history.
That's correct.
And so would you agree that the standard is reasonable suspicion? It's not probable cause at that point.
It's reasonable suspicion. That's true for a totality of the circumstances. But I don't believe he had any reasonable suspicion, and I don't think he was operating good faith.
And you could always wonder if you knew that they'd ever been arrested. The problem is, then you could always wonder if they maybe were arrestable again.
That's exactly right. And no person would ever be able to be free from a prior arrest or prior criminal history.
But then again, following up on Judge Russell's question, to a certain extent, if this officer, it's a small town, 500 people, this officer's been arresting this guy for not having warrants for years, and he has him in his car, wouldn't he have a reasonable suspicion he may have a warrant against him and maybe check that?
Well, there's nothing on the record to show that this officer ever arrested Mr. Grayson, just that he had been arrested before. And if this was the state's burden of proof at the hearing, shouldn't they have presented a little bit more evidence to try to support that there was reasonable suspicion?
Well, the standard is, I mean, if there isn't a specific finding, right, we're to defer to the trial court's findings in accordance with the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, I think Siebert, 8 of the 9, thought it should be objective, but Kennedy was the key vote, and so it was the one-person vote, and some people's views is the majority on subjective, and there's a dichotomy of the courts on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is taken under submission.